He placed his phone on what I assumed was a nearby stool, and for the next 5 minutes, I sat and listened to RZA perform ad-libs for a new song, where he would just make beeping noises or yell lasers at the top of his lungs every few seconds. One time he commanded the engineer to bring it back, then just repeated the same high-pitched robot sounds he'd been making since he started. It was like if Johnny Five from Short Circuit rapped. It was surreal, and had I not known what he was doing, I would have figured it was the weirdest case of Tourette syndrome ever documented. I sat with my mouth agape, seeing this as the coolest fan moment ever, akin to having Michael Jordan dunk on you over and over again in practice. Eventually the song ended and he picked the phone back up like nothing strange had just happened. Sorry about that. So let me get this straight. You're like the Richie Cunningham of hip-hop? RZA asked, trying to figure out exactly who he was talking to. Sort of, I responded. I'm actually not that big of a nerd, though. Oh, cool. So you're more like the Fonz? I sort of understood RZA's logic, but shrugged my shoulders at this analogy, too. Well, that actually might be too cool. I think I'm just trying to be myself more than anything. Okay, well then you're Potsy, RZA quickly responded. I'm not sure why we're sticking to a Happy Days theme, but sure, I guess I'm more like a Potsy, I conceded, assuming I could now pick RZA's favorite TV show with one guess. I always like to think he did the same thing with other rappers, and maybe once told Inspect the Deck he was a real Chachi. We talked for a few minutes about song concepts, including my passion for the idea of him sampling Christopher Cross's Ride Like the Wind, a song he immediately recognized by saying, yeah, I know that shit, which is the response you hope for when you ask RZA if he knows a yacht rock classic. I wished him luck on the new record and we hung up, never following up to work on a song together. Honestly, though, I never really pushed to make it happen with RZA, possibly because of nerves and also because I thought I could never top that phone call. Either way, I was wrong. As painful as this is to admit, about 4 years ago, our paths crossed again when I found myself at a party thrown by one of the Real Housewives of Beverly Hills for their grading reality TV show. A friend involved in organizing the event had asked me to come support his efforts, promising a gaudy extravaganza, and I had obliged. He did not disappoint. There were semi-nude models painted green and hiding in trees, simulating an orgy, a large ivy garden where mysterious arms would pop out and hand you mixed drinks, and enough C-list celebrities to make a VH1 casting agent salivate a tsunami. To cope with these bonkers surroundings, I decided to quickly down a few cocktails and silence the echo of "What the fuck are you doing here?" that dominated my brain. Right when I figured I couldn't take it anymore, I noticed RZA on the other side of the party. I had never seen him in a casual social setting, and with our brief phone interaction, mixed with the added confidence of the alcohol served me by weirdo ghost hands, I figured we had something to talk about. So I approached RZA, who seemed to be having as hard of a time at this shit show as I was, and said hello. He was cordial when I told him that Wu-Tang changed my life, a statement I was smart enough to withhold as Hot Carl, but now was shameless and buzzed enough to blurt out in my 30s. This is the moment when I should have adhered to a set of social standards and walked away, but restraint was not fitting me well that evening. "We talked on the phone once," I said to RZA, like we had an undeniable connection we could never forget. RZA looked at me, understandably confused. "I was a rapper named Hot Carl, and you were making noises. I mean, you were recording. We were going to work together," I managed to explain terribly. "We worked together?" RZA asked me with an actual excitement to connect. "Well, no, we almost did. Maybe. I don't know. They would have paid you a lot. But we talked about Happy Days." RZA stared at me. "You like Happy Days, right?" I asked, happily reaching for anything we could relate to. "The TV show? I guess," he responded indifferently. We had hit a dead end. This cul-de-sac of hero worship had nowhere else to go. I was now a random fan who was entering creepy zone. To break the silence, I blurted out without any explanation, "Well, I'm a Potsy," and walked away. I never told anyone about this humiliating exchange, knowing that if I couldn't explain it to the RZA, I couldn't explain it to anyone else. I do know, however, that when my $500,000 budget was still open, RZA had been a real big Happy Days fan. In addition to scheduling phone calls with my idols, DJ was also setting up recording sessions with up-and-coming local producers, hoping to get tracks strong enough to make an eventual album. My focus had shifted from signing a record deal to creating a full release ready for the Interscope schedule. And one of the producers responsible for getting this done went by the name of Damon Elliott. The son of Dionne Warwick, Elliott had worked with Destiny's Child and was impressed enough with my first few songs that he wanted to take a shot at working with me. The industry was extremely high on Elliott that year, since he was one of the producers credited with the Lady Marmalade reboot with Christina Aguilera, Maya, Pink, and Lil' Kim. Because he now had a number one hit under his belt, collaborating with him would be considered a coup, and I was excited at the prospect. Damon was a lovable teddy bear, overweight, bouncy, and extremely unpredictable. If he wasn't treated for ADHD as a kid, his pediatrician should have their license revoked. He could never say "Hot Carl" in just a calm, regular tone. He would scream it loudly, no matter how close I was, adding a James Brown funk to the end. His high-pitched name check became a constant during our sessions together, as he'd just yell it sporadically at random times without warning. One time as I walked into his studio ready to record, he jumped off his couch, visibly excited, yelling my name and handing me a phone. "Hot Carl! Hot Carl! Hot Carl! You gotta hear this!" I assumed it was a great song he was hearing for the first time, so I excitedly pushed my ear against the receiver, hoping to share his reaction. I soon realized, however, that I wasn't listening to a song at all. I was listening to a voicemail that Pink, nay Alicia Moore, had left for Damon earlier that day. "Damon, it's Alicia. Fuck that piece of shit, Hot Carl or whatever his name is." She sounded tired and really angry. Maybe even drunk. "If I ever see that motherfucker, I swear to God I'm gonna knock him out." Damon quickly snatched the phone from my ear and hung it up. He ran over to his console to start playing me beats as if nothing was wrong. I didn't know much about Damon Elliott, but I did know that Pink was very muscular and without a shadow of a doubt could beat the shit out of me. I panicked. He started turning knobs. "You like this one, dude?" he asked, looking at me for approval as an instrumental blasted over the speakers. "Sure," I yelled, focused on something much less melodic. "But why does Pink want to beat me up, man?" Damon turned the music down and explained that he had been listening to my song Bounce while she was in the studio a few nights before, and a line had caught her attention. Like the detective piecing together Kevin Spacey's fake story at the end of The Usual Suspects, everything fell into place for me. I remembered in that song I jokingly rapped, "My flow is sick, people get scared away, it's like partaking in a threesome with Pink and Macy Gray." Although it was a ridiculous joke to me, and so over the top that I found it weird that anyone would take it seriously, much like my prior experience with Tyrese, my target didn't seem to agree. Damon said she asked for my phone number immediately, but he was smart enough to keep that information to himself. He went on to reveal that she'd left similar messages, like the one I'd just heard, a few times. He told me not to worry, though. She'd forget about it soon. But he added, "I'd love to see y'all fight. Would be fun. Hot Carl!" I vehemently disagreed. Luckily, this beef never took shape beyond this instance. But to be honest, even over a decade later, I still worry about Pink every so often.
Bounce lyrics, 1999, 20 years old. "Now you rolling with the hotness, so let's make no mistakes here. Well, it's the H.O.T. man, I hope you're hearing this. Open the bar tab, take a shot, get ridiculous. Let your hair down tonight, shit, why not shave it off? Make it all bald, get really fucking tossed."
I always rapped about what I knew, and I was right in the middle of a college social scene about to turn 21, so I was quick to rap about drinking and partying. I thought it sounded cool. Listening to it now, I sound like a narc.
"Take this night off. Come on, don't act hard. It's like Coyote Ugly, baby. Dance up on the bar. You're a rock star. It'll probably make you stronger. Drink Red Bull and vodka till you can't talk no longer. 'Cause this is for the clubs, but without a catchy jingle. 'Cause that style sounds faggy like that one Shaggy single. It wasn't me."
Ugh, another cameo from homophobia. I still hate Shaggy, though.
"Fact is, I could do this backwards. Like Puff and Biggie on the freeway. Now give me some leeway. 'Cause partying ain't bad for me. What's it gonna do to me? I'ma change it up like Bow Wow's voice after puberty. And when you diss this, I return vicious. Make you feel left out like Jewish kids on Christmas. With the bounce, come on, bounce, come on. Bounce with the with the bounce, come on, bounce, come on. You rolling with the H, the O, the T for she's. Come on, bounce, come on, bounce, come on. Bounce with the with the bounce, come on, bounce, come on. What up, get drunk, get fucked now. My flow is sick, people get scared away. It's like partaking in a threesome with Pink and Macy Gray."
And there you have it.
"Or Latifa in lingerie, it's gross. My visuals make you vomit when you close. 'Cause keeping it real is so much different than you. If I talked about guns, then it wouldn't be true. So I stick to what I see and to shit I believe. Never faking I'm a thug just to sell CDs. There's still rules to kill and haters to prove malicious. Make them see the light, like Hammer when he went religious. And shit that comes out, it don't move me. They should never play in real theaters like Ice-T movies."
I figured one small jab at Ice-T for my abandoned childhood rap career would make us even. Joke's on me, though, since no one ever heard this song, and Ice-T has been making Dick Wolf money for 2 decades.
So, wannabes, I'm no longer having it. I keep it real while you fake like Madonna's British accent. So keep drinking till you're almost dead. Then when you're finished throwing up, go ahead and tap another keg. With the bounce, come on, bounce, come on. Bounce with the With the bounce, come on. You rolling with the H, the O, the T for she's. Come on, bounce, come on, bounce, come on. Bounce with the With the bounce, come on. What up, get drunk, get fucked now. There's a million MCs doing a song about bouncing, but with the verses that I kick, I make it original sounding. So put your hands up, move them side to side. Damn it, start freaking out like you're all justified. Take it all in, it won't happen again. A hip-hop MC who looks just like you and your friends.
Little did I know, come 2016, most every rapper would end up looking like they play beach volleyball.
And dudes, check your attitudes, even crack a smile. And hoes, lift up your shirts like it's girls gone wild. I want you to bounce, come on, shake it, fuck it. Get trashy like NASCAR or white kids with mullets. The club is jumping, so guys, get your brains. Ain't no way you're going home alone tonight, so spit game. And hoes, for one night, act dumber. Shake your ass, tease guys, and give 'em fake phone numbers. 'Cause you only live once, that's as far as we know, so enjoy the show, pop your collar, let yourselves go. With the bounce, come on, bounce, come on, bounce with the With the bounce, come on, you rolling with the H, the O, the T for she's. Come on, bounce, come on, bounce, come on, bounce with the With the bounce, come on. What up? Get drunk, get fucked now.
I genuinely thought this could be a catchy hook for a hot song. Hearing it now, it sounds like I'm having a stroke. Chapter 11. Cisco's Triple X Collection. Despite the off-putting start, Damon Elliott and I ended up recording a track together called His Hotness, predominantly using the weird way he yelled, "Hot Carl!" in the beat. As my first guest feature, Damon had Maya come in and sing the hook for a fee negotiated between her lawyers and the label. $15,000 and a co-production credit, though she never touched the actual backing track. That's like being called the chef for an entree you only put parsley on. I did get to meet her while she was half asleep on a couch after cutting her vocals, though. We talked about quesadillas, and I never saw her again. I basically paid her $15,000 to shake my hand, sing for an hour, take a nap, and then talk to me about a specific Mexican delicacy she loves. Highway robbery aside, she did sound great on the song, and my mom was super impressed that I met her. And with the added pressure of having a platinum artist on the hook now, I wanted the verses to double as an introduction to Hot Carl, something that could establish who I was if someone was only listening because of Maya. Eminem was releasing more and more music, and our voices were becoming more and more inseparable. I saw this as a perfect opportunity to differentiate myself, thinking Interscope's investment in the song would guarantee it a place in the marketplace. However, if you ask me, the main reason Maya's contribution sounded dope was my co-writer on the track, a guy named Marquise Da Kid Collins, one of the geniuses behind Cisco's Thong Song, a track that was nominated for 4 Grammys, which coincidentally is 4 more than any Bob Marley song. I'm going to keep doing this when needed. The results weren't quite God Only Knows by the Beach Boys. We rhymed Bum Bum and Dum Dum, but we worked so well together that he immediately invited me to another writing session, this time not for Hot Carl, but for Cisco's new album. How I fit into Cisco's creative team was something I couldn't yet grasp, but I knew I wasn't going to question it, especially after I found out that the writing session would take place in Cisco's San Fernando Valley mansion. As an avid Drew Hill fan, nothing in the world could stop me from taking this gig. My college suitemates were impressed with this new development in my career and became obsessed with telling me their theories, largely fueled by online rumors about how Cisco was gay. It was all opinion or third-hand gossip, but they were adamant about their speculation and made me promise I'd share every detail when I got home. "You should hook up with him," my fratty friend suggested. Cisco's house was enormous, surrounded by columns and grounded in expensive marble. The recording studio was outside, in a shed next to the impressive swimming pool, hidden like a doomsday prepper's gun arsenal. The kid and I worked in the studio for most of the day, with Cisco coming in to say hello a few times over the course of the afternoon. He couldn't have been nicer, even complimenting his hotness, which the kid had played for him earlier that week. He thanked me for working on his music and then excused himself to run some errands. In other words, Cisco and I were homies. Since the studio was in the backyard, when I had to go to the bathroom a few hours later, the kid informed me that I'd have to go back into the main house. He explained that the restroom would be easy to find, mentioning stairs and Cisco's room, then a sharp right. As I made my way through the house, reciting the directions in my head, I realized that I had stepped foot into Cisco's bedroom. It wasn't quite the sexy master layer you'd expect from the man who once sang Unleash the Dragon, clearly not referencing his love for the novels of George R.R. Martin. It actually looked like any room you'd find in my college dorm. Every item reeked of IKEA. The bed sat on the floor like he couldn't afford a frame. Dirty laundry was scattered everywhere. Cisco may have sung about taking a girl home with him from the club, but I couldn't imagine she stayed long. I laughed it off and continued walking to where I saw the nearby toilet. On my final step, I noticed stacks and stacks of DVDs flanking the sides of Cisco's big screen television, and as a movie buff myself, my interest was piqued. It looked like he was cataloging movies the same way the ghost librarian from the beginning of Ghostbusters cataloged books. As I got closer, I was shocked to see that they were all pornos, maybe over 50 titles. Although it felt like a violation, I knew that if I told my college friends I'd had an opportunity to see what type of porn Cisco watched, apparently in bulk, and hadn't investigated, they would haze me until graduation. So I slowly tiptoed to the stacks, picked up a handful from the top, and focused on the pictures. The pornos were heterosexual, straight as an arrow. Then I squinted my eyes and noticed a detail I almost missed. Each movie was actually a gangbang. I relentlessly checked every DVD, frantic like Claire Danes figuring out a terrorist plot on Homeland, and realized that almost all of the movies around me were flicks where dozens to hundreds of men were having sex with one woman. Yes, they were all heterosexual porn movies, but they also contained a ton of dick. Like 100-to-1 dick to vagina ratio. What was I to do? I knew too much. I quickly went to the bathroom and tried to understand what this odd collection of smut meant with regard to my roommate's gossip. There I was, standing in an Encino bathroom at a mansion that was furnished like a messy model home, contemplating the meaning of gangbang porn found in Cisco's bedroom. I heard a loud noise from downstairs, which I quickly thought to be a garage door opening. Terrified that the R&B crooner had returned home, I successfully ran downstairs to rejoin the kid for work without bumping into anyone, all the while attempting to forget what I'd just seen. But before I made my way back into the studio, I took a few souvenirs. When I got back to school, my friends hounded me for juicy gossip. I told them Cisco was polite and hospitable, and that sadly we didn't come up with a song that had even the slightest chance of making his album. I also let them know that I saw stacks and stacks of pornos, but that each was heterosexual, proving their assumptions wrong. They seemed disappointed as I left the room. Over the next month, I would quietly leave gangbang DVDs stolen from Cisco's house in each of their rooms when they weren't home and wait to hear anything about their discoveries. They never said a word. Funny thing is, they'll never know those pornos were from Cisco's personal collection. Discs I had to hide in my waistband, now finding their way into a college dude's masturbation rotation. No matter the nature of Cisco's sexuality, my tough guy roommate sure seemed to like jerking off to the same stuff. I distinctly remember the day I went in to write for Cisco because it was my last day as Paige's boyfriend. Also because I stole pornos from Cisco's house, and I feel like that's a life milestone. Between homework and the album, I was feverishly working all day and night, unable to see my family, let alone go on dates, so I decided the most sensible thing to do was break up. We had grown apart, especially with her world still revolving around sorority socials and midterms, and mine now taking place inside recording studios and R&B stars' mansions. And I'd be lying if I didn't admit that the grass did seem much greener on this side of the road to rap superstardom. Even though I genuinely liked Paige, and she had adored me before record deal was even in my vocabulary, I knew there was no possible way I could stay faithful with this type of temptation in my early 20s. I tried my hardest to stay committed, but I was starting to feel like a newly converted vegan working at a butcher shop. She obviously didn't quite see it as cut and dried as I did, and it broke her heart, and mine, that she had become a cliche. Girlfriend left in the dust. But I was just too nervous about having regrets at any point of this fun-filled journey. I was ready to take advantage of the newfound attention, and college Jensen was fading further and further away in the rearview mirror. Chapter 12, Blind Item. I'll never truly know what my life would have been like had I not called into the radio station to battle that day, but I can assume I would have had fewer interactions with celebrities. Throughout my entire time as Hot Carl, I found myself in some pretty crazy situations with household names. For example, Justin Timberlake once invited me to his private birthday party at Dublin's after attending one of my shows. That night, we talked at length about how Xbox got him a stand-up Halo arcade for his house and how LA didn't have any great barbecue spots. I was also the first rapper to mention Paris and Nicki Hilton in a song. I'ma hit that shit like I was Roger Maris, then fuck Nicki Hilton just to leave Paris embarrassed. A distinction revealed to me by Nicki herself. And in what may have been the coolest moment of my career, Janet Jackson once watched me perform and gave me the thumbs up when I saw her later near the bar. In all honesty, I never felt truly comfortable among these types, at least out of the studio, but I tried my hardest to fit in and live up to the once-in-a-lifetime opportunities I was having. So when one A-list celebrity asked me if I wanted to fuck her, I imagined I should probably say yes. I don't plan on revealing her name, not because I'm concerned with keeping her reputation intact or because I'm ashamed, but purely because it feels douchey to just come out and say it. Listen, Tyrese gets pedicures. Cisco has porn. Those things you know now. But nothing makes me feel more like an asshole main character in Entourage than rattling off the names of people I've hooked up with. You're on your own for this one. I had known of her work for years and unexpectedly found myself frequently around her because of a mutual friend I'd first met during my time as Hot Carl. I wouldn't say I had a crush, but like most young men during that era, I saw her as an unattainable sex symbol, a fact I even joked about with a lyric on my demo. She was polite and funny and surprisingly down to earth at times, despite being on TV every day. We'd hug hello and goodbye, and I'd actually have said we were becoming pals. Whether because of her fame or our purely platonic conversations, I never really imagined her as much more than a friend, and a surreal one at that. It wasn't until one dinner when I thought I saw her winking at me from across the room that I allowed myself to imagine it could be anything different. When I did think of the possibility, I quickly brought myself back to reality, laughing it off as just rapid-fire blinking on her part. Who even winks at someone in the 21st century? I called one of my friends the next morning and relayed the story. I admitted she could have been joking around, but the more I thought about it, I was almost sure she was coming on to me. My friend was skeptical, and to be honest, so was I. After our talk, I convinced myself that I had made it all up in my head and went back to understanding that, although I had been lucky to date out of my league a few times, I wasn't about to hook up with a girl who's been on every magazine cover. But to my surprise, after this winking incident that may or may not have happened, I noticed that we started kissing on the lips whenever we'd greet each other. It was shocking at first, but European in nature, and despite the fact that she was born in the United States, I thought it might be par for the celebrity course. Because how could it be anything else? One night, she had a party at her house to screen her new TV show, and I was happy to attend. After we watched it in a big group, I was one of the last viewers to walk up and congratulate her. I was impressed by the scope of the project and made sure to tell her she should be proud of the final product. She thanked me for the kind words and went in for the hug. To my utter surprise, she stayed in that position for a little too long, and I followed her lead. And just as I started to question whether I was misreading signs again, she started lightly moaning and grinding up against me. I started to believe that maybe the winks weren't a nervous tic after all. She tilted her head over to peck my neck, and with a handful of people surrounding us, she started making out with me. As much as I wanted to yell, "Holy shit," and send an email to every girl who ever rejected me, I could taste the alcohol, and even though I was buzzed myself, I immediately felt uncomfortable. When she whispered in my ear asking if I could stay over, a million thoughts went through my head. As badly as I wanted to just scream, "Yes, ma'am," and run to her bedroom with pants around my ankles, gentlemanly instincts took over and I politely replied, "Let's wait until you're sober. We can do this another time." I grabbed a nearby pen and paper and wrote down my phone number to stick on her refrigerator. "You'll call me and we'll do this whole thing again next week." As if I hadn't just suggested a dose of common sense, we started kissing again. "I don't know if this is a good idea," I repeated. With that, she pulled away and said something along the lines of, "Don't you want to know what this feels like?" and pointed toward her crotch. As much as her question sounded like something you'd find on a frat guy's t-shirt during spring break in the 80s, I knew my answer was yes. I said goodbye to our mutual friend who had driven me to her house earlier that night and informed him I'd be staying over. He laughed and wished me luck. Looking back, I recognized that these words of encouragement were both genuine and a friendly warning of what was to come. I walked back into the house, noticing that the 100 or so guests who had been there earlier for the premiere had now disappeared. We immediately started kissing again in the kitchen. She interrupted the second session to lead me back into her screening room, where I assumed we would disrobe and start hooking up. As she walked in the direction of the cable box, I realized she wasn't leading me there to get cozier. We had re-entered the room to watch her show's debut episode again. Frustrated, I sat there as she went over every scene and supplied me with pieces of trivia I can't imagine will ever come in handy. It was my very own cock-blocking director's commentary. We got through the show again, now sobering up, and she asked if I wanted to go to her bedroom. With the type of excitement usually only seen when a second grade nerd raises his hand after the teacher asks if anyone wants to read aloud, I jumped off the couch and shouted, "Yes." Finally, I imagined things were going to fall into place. After a few minutes of making out in her bed, she took her shirt off and I unhooked her bra. I had just called it off with the easygoing water polo playing Paige, but our relationship couldn't have felt further in the distance now that I found myself fondling the gigantic breasts of a girl who a few of my college friends had plastered on their walls. If anything had felt completely unbelievable during my time as an accidental rapping top prospect, it was this moment in particular. As it got hot and heavy, she began to unzip my pants. Content with where things were leading, I couldn't help but smile a little. That's the moment I heard the bedroom door swing open. Startled, I jumped out of bed, ready to attack whichever member of the bling ring had just barged in to rob us. My kissing partner was unaffected, showing no signs of concern with the spontaneous entrance. Still topless, the celebrity looked up and introduced me to her publicist, a pretty girl who casually sat at the edge of the bed and got comfortable. I had been convinced we were alone in the house, but now came to the conclusion that I probably didn't know everything that was going on, or was about to unfold. I assume most of you think this is going to turn into a lurid tale of a Hollywood threesome involving a megastar and her attractive publicist, but now I need you to imagine the exact opposite of that scenario, and then get ready for that. The publicist started complaining about her longtime boyfriend and how her feet were uncharacteristically swollen, all while my one-time horny partner put her clothes slowly back on. My erection dissipated as the celeb dug deep into her friend's current relationship predicament and foot problem to dole out advice. And after they addressed those problems, they started talking about the TV show again, noting things that could change for future episodes and elements they thought really worked moving forward. Even Daniel Day-Lewis would have been like, "This is too much prep." Eventually, after about an hour, the publicist stopped talking in order to lie down directly in between us, almost pushing her way in as a barrier. The celebrity also got comfortable, now pulling the sheets over her body to signal sleep time, leaving me on the outside, completely ignored. As they both dozed off, cuddling each other, I asked if I could borrow a toothbrush, since it's always been difficult for me to sleep without brushing my teeth. She mumbled, now understandably half asleep at 3 a.m., "I don't have any." Learning that she didn't have a single toothbrush in her house, I now sat motionless in her bed, almost hanging off the side and being pushed even farther every second by the dynamic duo. I was without my car, and my cell phone had died hours ago, leaving me no way to retrieve numbers from it. The only digits I could readily recall were my parents, and I wasn't sure how I'd explain this predicament to my mom. A fatal shooting in Van Nuys seemed easier to explain. I knew I would never find a phone charger in this dark mansion, so instead I tried to cut my losses by closing my eyes and trying to fall asleep. Problem is, anxiety kicked in, keeping me wide awake and forcing me to constantly worry about how I'd eventually get home. I began to think the Amityville Horror family had it easy. For the next 5 hours, I waited for the sun to come up, giving me just enough light to find a charger in a downstairs drawer and beg the first person who picked up my call to save me. I left her house and never went back. It took me a full day to even comprehend what had happened that night, so when I saw our mutual friend and he asked how it went, I shook my head and kept walking. It was a night I didn't plan on recounting to anyone, and I was content with it forever being my little secret failure. Sadly, my embarrassment wasn't the only thing bothering me. In addition to the shame, I woke up with a nagging sensation in both of my eyes. It was more of an annoyance than an actual pain, but I couldn't ignore the feeling as I tried to go about my day. My eyes felt heavy and tired, but I chalked it up to lack of sleep and assumed everything would go back to normal after some well-deserved rest. So when I woke up the next morning with both eyes sealed shut and uncontrollable pus oozing out from my sockets, I realized this was probably more serious than I had thought. I had a friend rush me to a doctor who immediately put on surgical gloves and went to work opening my eyes, which were still completely closed from crust. The physician took a sample of the discharge and returned a few minutes later with a bit of a puzzled look on his face. "This is one of two things," the doctor told me as he looked down at some notes. "You either have one of the worst sinus infections I've ever seen, or you had sex with a cheap Vietnamese hooker." Until that moment, I never thought the situation with my eyes had anything to do with my most recent hookup, especially since we basically stopped at first base. I assumed you had to at least slide head first into third to catch any sort of STD. I told the whole story to my doctor, who explained, perfectly hiding any secondhand humiliation he had, that if the person you're touching is unhygienic in any manner, you can catch every sickness under the sun. Before he even finished the sentence, I remembered the fact that there wasn't even one toothbrush in her house or soap in her bathroom, something I had noticed when I tried to wash my hands in the morning. And just like that, one of the most famous women in the world, who had the personal upkeep of Pigpen from Peanuts, had almost certainly given me a crippling eye disease. As a result, I was put on medication and reevaluated twice over the next 3 weeks, racking up doctor's bills of around $1,200. I would see the famous girl a few more times over the next year at get-togethers and events, but I'd avoid hugs and wave from afar. She eventually got married, and our paths no longer crossed. I found myself in some pretty outlandish situations over the years because of rapping, but none as disgusting as this romantic encounter. When I finally realized that her original winking probably wasn't flirting at all, but most likely an eye disease that she would eventually pass on to me, it was the worst possible M. Night Shyamalan ending our hookup could have had.
His Hotness, Lyrics, 1999. 20 years old. Nowadays the rap game's got me furious. I'm curious why all these rappers act so serious. Cool out, chill man, stop acting so mad, or I'm kicking you out your group like I was Beyonce's dad. His Hotness is bringing new views, 'cause I'm sick that college dudes only feel Dave Matthews. Well, I've been influenced from Run-DMC to Motley Crue, while you all act ignorant like white people in FUBU. It's a brand new thing, no violence, no bling-bling. I just love the fun in hip-hop, so that's the style I bring. So go and leave the anger and stress at work or at school, 'cause that rules, it's time for hip-hoppers to act cool. And if you were real gangsters, you wouldn't talk on it. You all are liars, except for Mobb Deep, they seem honest.
For some reason, I always assumed that Queensbridge's own Mobb Deep was being honest when they threatened to kill you on record. A few years later, Jay-Z would expose a picture of Prodigy, one half of the group, dressed as a ballerina for childhood dance lessons. That's when I realized everyone was full of shit and God isn't real.
It's my time, so Maya comes sing after this line. I'm gonna go run through the suburbs yelling out, free shine.
As I said, I didn't write this hook, and I'm not about to get all Carmen Sandiego trying to figure out if I could publish the lyrics 15 years later. Let's just agree, sight unseen, that it's probably the most important stanza recorded for public consumption since Bone Thugs said they missed their Uncle Charles.
Suburbanite, rhymes tight, blazes mics. No mention of gunfights or platinum ice, futures bright like mag lights. You got me and DE, we make it all love and nice. A black and white team like Crockett and Tubbs, Miami Vice. I'm not claiming a gang, I'm just screaming my name, Hot Carl, at the top of my lungs like I'm insane. I'm recording tracks in between all of my college classes, spiky hair, studded belt, black-rimmed glasses. So I'm considered too pretty to flow dirty and gritty, stereotyped, 'cause I'm from the suburbs and not the city. Visually I'm like cable, 'cause only half of you get me, but then you heard the music and you turned half of a 360. I'm trying to keep it real and still stay funny. Influenced by hip-hop when I was younger, so I studied, and made songs on four tracks in high school with my buddies, never thinking one day I'd spend all of Interscope's money. I want the fun back in rap like it's 1985, like Biz Markie or the Fat Boys when they were all alive. You would think in the rap game we would all be one and equal. Come on, I thought this was America, people. But I still get weird looks, like I should leave the scene, 'cause I'm a bit clean-cut and I smile in magazines. And I'm not really that mean, unless you fuck in with my team, wipe your eyes a couple times to realize what you are seeing. And I'm poking fun at people, so you might want to fight me. Be happy you're a celebrity and take this shit lightly.
Pink was obviously still on my mind, even hours later while writing this song. I was a real tough rapper.
Fuck, I'm like the Dirk Nowitzki of the rap game, while y'all are lame like Puff Daddy changing his name. So this is the manifesto to prove that I'm for real, not some Johnny come lately who found himself a record deal. But for now you act bitter and you make me annoyed, 'cause truth is I'm not acting like Tyrese in Baby Boy.
Never forget where you come from. Chapter 13, My Night with Gerardo. Newly single and off to a weird start, when I did have a rare night off from recording, I started to frequent trendy Hollywood nightclubs, now able to skip any line because of the record deal hoopla. The news had reached hotshot promoters like Brent Bolthouse and Amanda Demme, who ruled LA's celebrity social scene with events at spots like Joseph's, The Lounge, and Club AD. These were places where people would line up outside for 2 hours, only to be told they couldn't get in when they finally got to the front. I had experienced that disappointment a few times and sworn I'd never do it again. But now I was being invited as a VIP, and being back on the market, I figured clubbing would be a lot more fun. One night I found myself at Drew Barrymore's house for an after-hours party that started with Jell-O shots and ended with skinny dipping. A year later, I watched a recently broken up Justin Timberlake and Britney Spears have a surreal dance-off in the middle of the floor, an event that has since become pop culture legend. I was partying alongside people like Heather Graham, Tobey Maguire, and Kirsten Dunst. But no matter who or what I saw at these events, I was no longer meeting college girls who wore pearls and talked about marriage. I started hooking up with Playboy playmates and runway models who seemed just as interested in my open budget as hip-hop producers were. The first girl I hooked up with after my breakup introduced me to fake breasts, while another girl's dad owned a helicopter because he'd invented the electronic ear pick. The connection with my ex-girlfriend revolved around miniature golf dates and rented movies. Now I was drunkenly bringing WB guest stars and music video dancers back to my dorm room, participating in the first one-night stands of my life. Despite being signed for almost 6 months at this point, it wasn't until 2001 when my love life drastically changed that I finally started to feel like a rap star. In addition to the girls at clubs, my record label was also starting to pay more attention to me. I'd walk through the halls of the Santa Monica Interscope office, and employees would come out to greet me at every step. Word of my priority at the label and of the positive early response to my new music was traveling fast. DJ may have had Jimmy's ear thanks to a family tree, but he was also very good at getting the word out throughout the company. Everyone was interested in meeting the new white rapper Jimmy signed, especially one 90s icon who had recently made the transition from artist to executive. At one time, Gerardo was the hunky one-hit wonder who repeatedly said Rico Suave in a sexy voice, earning Interscope's first number one single. But he had since become a well-respected A&R at the company, most notably signing Enrique Iglesias to his first American record deal. I had poked fun at both of them on Caliente Carlito, a song now so highly regarded at the label that many of its employees would sing the hook back at me when I'd meet them. Gerardo explained that he had been pushing Interscope to sign me from the minute he heard the fake Latino track and had made sure Enrique heard it immediately, which was a fact I would later verify when I met the singer and he couldn't stop laughing and quoting lyrics. Even cooler than that, a year or so after this initial meeting, Gerardo would ask me to write the sequel to Rico Suave for a possible midlife comeback, a writing gig I still think may be the strangest coup of my career. I penned the ridiculous song Es Gerardo from start to finish in 30 minutes, bragging in his voice that he could still steal your girl and that Rico Suave is where most of you kids learn to speak Spanish from. We became fast friends, and he couldn't have been a better dude. As if writing the track wasn't enough to fulfill my need for kitsch, Gerardo asked me to perform as his hype man at the House of Blues in Los Angeles in what would be the first time he'd perform Es Gerardo live and his first show at all in years. I couldn't say yes fast enough. When I arrived at the House of Blues, I was pleasantly surprised to see a completely sold-out venue, comprised mostly of music executive friends and nostalgic fans ready to have fun with the dated heartthrob. After his initial success, Gerardo, most recently seen on his own VH1 reality show, always relied on his undeniable likability and self-effacing honesty. He knew that releasing another album as Gerardo wasn't going to put him back on the Billboard Hot 100, but he was offered the opportunity by an independent Latin music label and figured it could at least be a fun adventure. And luckily, the audience shared that excitement, seeing him as more than an ironic curiosity to laugh at or a chance to act like a real-life YouTube comment section. Right after he asked me to join him on stage, I disclosed that I had a ridiculous idea on how to start his show, but I assumed there was no way he'd ever give it a shot. After telling me I was crazy a few dozen times, Gerardo admitted that my idea was the best possible introduction he could pull off. I walked onto the empty stage to the announcer begrudgingly introducing me as the next Latino-American hip-hop superstar, Hot Carl, a prologue I had written for myself, ignoring the look of disgust the sound guy gave me when I asked him to read it during soundcheck. The spotlight followed me to center stage as I heard a few friendly cheers from the audience, one even yelling, "Roll call!" like he was forced to blurt out the only way anyone in the room might know me. I spoke in the most serious tone I could muster, thanking each and every person in the audience for attending tonight's triumphant return, and then yelled over their applause to warn them about what they were about to experience. I know a lot of you came to see Gerardo of Rico Suave fame, but I have bad news for you. That man is not here tonight, I revealed to a smattering of confused boos. I went on, if you bought a ticket to see a grown man with shoulder-length perfect hair, tight jeans, a bandana, and a leather jacket with zippers strategically placed everywhere, then there's the door. I pointed to the exits while the boos got louder and harder to ignore. He's a grown man now. He has children. He's moved on, and so should you. I started to lecture with the ease of Nikolai Volkoff infuriating WWF crowds in the 80s. Let the man evolve and grow. He's not here to live in the past for you. He's here to play his new music and show the mature side of Gerardo, I chastised the entire House of Blues audience, which was now expressing its utter disappointment back at me. I basked in the anger, taking in each and every hiss, waiting for a tomato to be thrown. And just when the fever pitch of anger hit critical mass, the first note of Rico Suave unexpectedly hit the speakers loud. Ladies and gentlemen, Gerardo. Just like that, Gerardo emerged from backstage, dressed in the exact outfit he had worn a decade earlier in his frequently lampooned music video. At my request, he'd searched through storage units to find every piece of the ensemble, even contacting a Hard Rock Cafe to borrow the genuine Latin Till I Die leather jacket, which was now on display near a table where you could order Tupelo chicken tenders and see Fred Durst's hat. I even convinced him to sport hair extensions to cover his current buzz cut do. The crowd went bananas. I screamed, "Oh, you thought we were going to act too cool for this shit?" I couldn't hide my elation jumping around the stage like Tom Cruise on Oprah's couch. I assisted Gerardo through both Rico Suave and our song, Es Gerardo, pumping up the crowd between his verses, emphasizing his lines, and even helping him disrobe from his ridiculous costume. Gerardo thanked me as we finished the second track, and I held up his Latin Till I Die jacket like I was Anthony Michael Hall, proudly holding up Molly Ringwald's underwear and 16 candles. Selling out my first real show at the Roxy, or even opening for Snoop Dogg at Summer Jam, couldn't compete with the smile permanently frozen on my face that night. It brought me back to the era when I had started rapping. Gerardo obviously wasn't Rakim, Fife Dog, Kool G Rap, or any other rapper I idolized as a kid and would later open for, but as a pop culture aficionado, this was just too cool. When I was a middle schooler in Calabasas, only top 40 rap artists ever made their way into our school's lexicon, and here I was on stage with one of the few who got spun at our school dances. I had my own underground legends to worship, but I knew if I could go back in time, even my old idiot classmates would acknowledge this achievement. I stayed through the show, proud of my friend, and waiting to get my original Rico Suave cassette single signed once he came back to the dressing room. As he scribbled his name on my artifact, he looked up with a smile and said, "One day I'll be getting your autograph as you walk off stage." And although his sentiment was sweet, I was too happy to even hear it. In addition to fulfilling one of my boyhood dreams, Gerardo was also responsible for signing Bubba Sparks, a weird coincidence that I hadn't really addressed yet. His recent addition to Interscope's roster had further fueled the rumors that Jimmy was constructing an army of buzzworthy white MCs only to shelve them in the name of Eminem's world dominance. It continued to sound like a cumbersome plan to me, but Bubba's presence was the first shred of evidence. Still, it didn't stop me from loving the guy when I met him. I first met Bubba at his birthday dinner, a function I was invited to by the label in hopes that we would get along and work together, especially since Bubba's mentor was Timbaland, a man whose name was still being thrown around for a Caliente Carlito reboot. Bubba was an extremely gentle guy, and at first sight, just as stark of a contrast from your typical rapper as I was. He was a pale, baby-faced, corn-fed hick who strictly wore bright polo button-ups and khaki shorts. He seemed like he'd be more comfortable on a farm than in a recording studio, despite his undeniable skills, which helped guide his first hit single, Ugly, and the accompanying video, which had him wrangling pigs and riding tractors while rapping, to the top of the charts. At the dinner, Bubba and I talked about the Ugly clip, something he had just shot and had high hopes for, especially since Missy Elliott made a cameo appearance. I made sure to tell him I hadn't met her yet. And we chatted about the transition from making music with your friends to making music for a living. He was bright-eyed and enthusiastic, a demeanor I was happy to see we shared. However, a few drinks in, when we were more relaxed, we started to talk about the elephant in the room. We never wanted to publicly address the rumors, but as a team, we could approach them with confidence. We both admitted we had heard warnings that Jimmy was securing our deals to shelve us, but both disregarded it as hearsay and were happy with our decisions. But underneath the casual downplay, you could sense that both of us questioned the other's role at the label, and more importantly, our own. The optimism we both conveyed at this dinner would no longer exist the next time we hung out, but we enjoyed it while it lasted, getting drunk and eating steaks on the label's corporate card. Chapter 14, Will I Ain't. One rapper who wasn't quite getting access to Interscope's funds like Bubba and I were at the time was Will.i.am. I had known of the Black Eyed Peas frontman for most of my childhood, as he was a pioneer of sorts in the West Coast hip-hop scene, especially in the fields of dancing and battling. Way before selling out and rapping about lovely lady lumps or becoming a hologram on CNN, he was a scene gatekeeper of sorts, judging everyone on how real they were to hip-hop culture. Nowadays, it's laughable, but I was always terrified to rap in ciphers with Will1X, what he went by back then, let alone attempt to talk to the guy. After many years as an undisputable legend at LA hip-hop clubs like Radiotron and Ballistics, where he successfully battled other pre-fame MCs like Xzibit, Will caught Jimmy Iovine's eye with the Peas, an incarnation of Atband Clan, his prior group that experienced a failed record deal at Eazy-E's Ruthless Records. Interscope released the Black Eyed Peas' debut album, Behind the Front, while I was a freshman in college. And not only was I happy to see someone I recognized release a major label CD, I loved the music too. The album and its first single, Joints and Jam, were successful enough for Interscope to renew their contract and approach a follow-up, one that would find the group hoping to expand their audience into the mainstream with a more conscious effort toward pop music. But the transition wasn't quite as easy as you'd think. When I signed to Interscope, Will and the Black Eyed Peas, who did not yet have a female member, had just released that sophomore record, which they called Bridging the Gap, a reference to their attempt at capturing the pop audience with a polar opposite combination of big hooks and underground backpack influences. The album was a tremendous failure. Even though the group used a rough draft of what would eventually become their formula for making millions, something was missing. While everyone at Interscope knew Will was an incredibly talented musician on the cusp of something big, the future of the Black Eyed Peas was in jeopardy. DJ had confided in me that Jimmy was looking to drop the Peas from the label and possibly sign Will as a solo artist, which seemed to make sense because I'm still not 100% sure what the other two guys in the group do. It was this type of desperation that I believed forced will.i.am to become friends with me. Will would later admit in an interview that he was jealous of the Hot Carl project. He had ideas for the Black Eyed Peas' third album, which would eventually catapult him into another stratosphere. But Jimmy and DJ had moved on to other artists and were no longer returning his calls. The budget for Bridging the Gap had gone above and beyond what the label felt comfortable spending, especially in hindsight, once it failed, and now Will and his group of What Do You Do Anyway counterparts were one step from total industry exile. He had played me demos for hit songs like Let's Get Retarded, before its PC remake into Let's Get It Started, and Where Is the Love, but couldn't schedule a meeting with Jimmy to show them off. Strapped for cash, Will even started walking into LA recording studios he had worked at in the past, pretending he was still recording there just to get the free food in the kitchen. You can say a lot of things about will.i.am, but that he's a quitter isn't one of them. I knew Will didn't like my music, and I assumed that when he heard Jimmy was spending an exorbitant amount of money to sign me, it made him even more frustrated. The first few times we were introduced, Will would basically brush me off and act like I was a fan, and luckily for him, I was. A few months after I signed with Interscope, though, at a taping of FarmClub.com, a live music TV show that Jimmy Iovine and another music executive, Doug Morris, created for the USA Network, Will surprisingly walked up to me and started politely asking about my background in hip-hop. He wasn't being condescending or rude. It actually seemed like he was genuinely interested to learn more about the artist who was stealing the attention and available budget he needed. We exchanged phone numbers, and just like that, after years of intimidation, I was pals with one of my favorite rappers. At the same time, I had started working with DJ Homicide, another name with a storied past in underground hip-hop, who had since found his calling as the turntablist for the pop group Sugar Ray. Best known as the guy who says, "Shut the door, baby, don't say a word," on the song Every Morning, Homicide wanted to return to his roots and start making rap music again. A few weeks into working together, he played me a bouncy guitar track that was originally supposed to be on Sugar Ray's last album, but didn't quite make the cut. He explained that they had worked with DJ Quick on the song, and the West Coast legend had added his own drums, which truthfully was the best part. I placed my verses into the song, focusing on strong punchlines. "As far as being just another rapper, that's over. I'm the Jewish Jay-Z, the Hebrew Hova." An introspective anxiety. "If Hot Carl doesn't blow up, I'ma be pissed, because then I'm stuck with an H and a K tatted on my wrists." Knowing I was onto something big. Homicide loved what I had done with it, but we were both at a loss for what to do on the hook. Will had recently played me a song called Everybody, a funk-inspired jam he did with another neglected Interscope signee named Planet Asia, and it caught my attention. It wasn't the beat or Planet Asia's rap that really stuck out. It was the hook that Will half sang, half rapped. To me, it shined a spotlight on a new talent he could exploit in the pop world, specifically on my song with Sugar Ray and Quick. Unfortunately, DJ didn't seem to share my enthusiasm. He explained that Will might not even be part of the Interscope family in a few weeks, and that there was no buzz around him or the group, so it might be best to steer clear of including him on the album. I told him I didn't care about the label's politics, and that I knew what was best for the song. With that, I drove the track over to Will's studio, and 2 hours later, I not only had proof that this song could be my first single, but evidence that will.i.am still showed signs of life for Interscope. For as much posturing as Will did during his days as the Keep It Real monitor, he wholeheartedly loved the track and even dropped by one of my shows a week or two later just to perform it live with me. Will's eventual success had nothing to do with my song, trust me, I know that. But at the time, DJ admitted that his inclusion on my track, now titled Something Changed, did help Jimmy and the A&R division understand where the Black Eyed Peas could still go. For a few months after we recorded together, Will would call me about once a week, asking if I was with DJ, hoping I would pass the phone over. He knew that was the only way he could pin him down to talk about new BEP songs. Sometimes it would work out, while other times DJ motioned to say he wasn't there. I knew Will was using me for my position within the label, but I was fine with that because I truly believed in his talent. The night we recorded Something Changed, Will admitted to feeling low, giving me a rare look into his insecurity and vulnerability. He mentioned that he was most afraid because he had just bought his mother a house and wasn't sure he could afford to help her with the mortgage like he had promised. He admitted that he heard rumors the group was about to get dropped and worried about the future of his bandmates. I explained that including him on my song was the least I could do to try to get the label to notice him again. He thanked me. That's why his behavior once he blew up would be so shocking. Once the third Black Eyed Peas album, Elefunk, was released, there was no stopping the group, which now found the perfect combination of pop and rap in the form of a new member named Fergie. No matter how close they came to being released from Interscope, or how you feel about the change they made in their music to stay alive, with over 76 million records sold, they've become one of the world's best-selling groups of all time. They've won 6 Grammys. Popping back up here, Guns N' Roses never won a Grammy. And become one of only 11 artists to simultaneously hold both the number 1 and number 2 spots on the Billboard Hot 100, owning the top spot for a record 26 consecutive weeks. Any regrets Will may have had about ditching his credible underground past were obliterated a long time ago by his bank account. Years after ignoring his phone calls, Jimmy Iovine would even recognize Will's significant contribution to the Interscope empire by making him an equity partner in Beats by Dre, allegedly giving him 5% of the company and in turn around $125 million in its sale to Apple. He may have had his mom move from that house after all, but it was only to buy her a much bigger one. Will and I did keep in touch for a bit after he went mainstream, and we'd laugh about the 180 degrees the DJ and Jimmy turned since the days of Something Changed. He now solely referred to me as Harry Potter, both to my face and to others, a cute moniker he still uses to refer to my resemblance to the literary wizard and my Armenian background. And a few years into his career resurgence, he called me to collaborate on an idea for a movie he wanted to release alongside a solo record he was prepping. He hired me to sit in the studio with him for 2 weeks and knock out a script based on the songs he was recording. I agreed to do it, especially since he had promised me $3,500 no matter what came of the script. And so I sat in his studio as he worked with Common, Nas, and Fergie, just listening to the music and the way he talked. I eventually crafted a script inspired by his new material, and he seemed very excited by the results. But once it made its way to Interscope, they weren't quite as excited. The concept was killed before it ever left the ground. In an ironic twist, from that point on, Will and his manager stopped taking my calls, and I was never paid the $3,500 I was promised. About 2 years later, Will called me in the midst of what some might assume was a manic episode. But those who knew him well understood that this was just his way of being creative. He apologized for what had happened with the movie script, saying he always disagreed with Interscope's notes and wished he'd stood up to them, especially since the solo record tanked, an unpredictable result based on his hot streak at the time. He was talking so fast that his words were difficult to decipher. From what I could make out, he wanted to bring me back into the studio to write a Broadway musical he envisioned, based on the Slick Rick song Children's Story. He rapped parts of the classic track to me and explained his vision for how it would play out on stage. He wanted to meet as soon as possible to go over a possible partnership and asked about my schedule. I remember being somewhat flattered that Will would still think of me for an idea, but also burned over the money he owed me. As much as I wanted to say yes, as a fan of Will I Am, and more importantly, Will 1X, I declined. Surprised by my answer, he asked, "What's Harry Potter got going instead?" I calmly said, "Trying to buy my mom a house."
Something Changed. Lyrics. 2000. 20 years old. Things don't seem the same. Things is rearranged. Something's changed. I said, who done fucked it up? Who done fucked it up? Things don't seem the same. Things is rearranged. Something's changed. I said, who done fucked it up? Hot car gonna switch it back up. Something's changed. Let's go toe for toe. 'Cause nobody's watching you like Queen Latifah's talk show.
Queen Latifah was a frequent target in my songs, mentioned almost as often as Tyrese, for no reason other than I thought her career trajectory was so random. I'm actually a huge fan of her early songs. This joke about her talk show would work twice, separated by a decade, since she's had 2 daytime runs, and both times she delivered less than Marshawn Lynch at a press conference.
And as far as being just another rapper, that's over. I'm the Jewish Jay-Z, the Hebrew Hover. A college graduate, yo, I'm not here to fight. I don't get it. A white rapper who acts white. But when I grab the mic with the style that I bring, nerdy white kids line up like it was Lord of the Rings. It's changed. Try to front and play the high post. But admit that if we battle, then you ain't coming close. It's a joke. Ye must have thought I'd amount to zero, 'cause I list Suge Knight and Woody Allen as my heroes. Why's that kid on MTV with a sombrero?
I had assumed that by this point, audiences would have heard Caliente Carlito, and the video would have had me in a complete mariachi outfit. Instead, it just sounds like I want to be on MTV wearing a festive ethnic hat.
The man, while you just the fan like Bob De Niro. But if I'm found dead laying in a gutter, make a poetry CD and tell Meadow that I love her. Things don't seem the same. Things is rearranged. Something's changed. I said, who done fucked it up? Who done fucked it up? Things don't seem the same. Things is rearranged. Something's changed. I said, who done fucked it up? Who's the motherfucker that fucked it up? If Hot Carl doesn't blow up, I'ma be pissed, 'cause then I'm stuck with an H and a K tatted on my wrists. With a college education that didn't mean shit, 'cause I had the opportunity but couldn't make a hit.
My dad used to complain when I'd prophesize my eventual music industry failure, saying it was a jinx. Maybe he's right. But also, he was the Jewish parent, so if anyone is to blame for my negative outlook on life, it's him.
Oh well, I won't be surprised if that happens. We live in a world where O-Town goes platinum. It's hard to tell exactly what'll sell. I really miss Aaliyah, 'cause I'm stuck with Blue Cantrell. What the fuck? I mean, every rock rap group sounds exactly the same and still blows up. So now I'm pissed on some West Coast shit, so you know I had to make a call to DJ Quick.
Eventually I did have to contact DJ Quick to clear the song. Photographer Jonathan Mannion would introduce us by driving me to his house one weekend. Quick, an eccentric man in every sense of the word, was a bit jumpy that night, despite giving me full permission to work on and release the track. After an hour of casually hanging out and playing video games, his mood changed abruptly. He told us to leave because something scary was about to go down, implying that he had just been told someone was coming to his house. Jonathan and I proceeded to run out of his place at full speed, never knowing what he was referring to and never really wanting to find out.
'Cause to tell my story, it had to be bumping to prove the suburbs could flow just like Compton. Here's a rap lesson for kids who act shook. Here's the 16th bar. Now here's the hook. Things don't seem the same. Things is rearranged. Something's changed. I said, who done fucked it up? Who done fucked it up? Things don't seem the same. Things is rearranged. Something's changed. I said, who done fucked it up? Who's the motherfucker that fucked it up? I grew up with white kids that lived suburban lives, who graduated college just to work a 9-to-5, to satisfy the parents that they secretly despise. And when it's all exposed, people act like they surprised. I got dissed for rapping. Ain't that silly? 'Cause now they the ones going, uh-oh, with Nelly. It went mainstream and it caught mass appeal. Hey, that ain't bad. Shit, that's why I got a deal. But no matter what, I'ma just be me. Go triple platinum by myself and bang Alicia Keys. I'm here to make sure all those kids know the truth, that fake rappers hide in their trunks like Ray Caruth. And I make fun of people, so I'm genuinely hoping that cats in the game understand I'm only joking. But it's my time. HK gonna do it. Make 3 million kids scream out, keep it Jewish.
During the outro to the song, I shout out Will, the producers of the song, and even the Sugar Ray guitarist who plays on the track. I also asked DJ AM to bump the song at Las Palmas. He did throw it into the mix days after I recorded it, mostly because it was the first time anyone had ever said his name on a rap song, something he reminded me of just days before he passed away. Chapter 15. Big checks and very little balance. After a year of recording and a few possible singles under my belt, Interscope began to book sessions in New York City, the place where DJ had started his music career and thus had more established hip-hop connections. I had just graduated college, a feat Jimmy Iovine had promised would happen during my development and recording process, and I was happy to prove him right. It was mid-2001, and although there was still no set date to release the album, the positive feedback I was constantly getting, and the label's readiness to spend large amounts of money on travel, producers, and guest features, made it difficult to find anything in my life worth a complaint. However, days before my first musical trip to the East Coast, my parents informed me they'd be divorcing, which hit me like a ton of suburban-only child bricks. Their marriage and individual well-beings had disintegrated so quickly it was jarring. The two people who were so supportive and positive throughout my entire life had grown apart and into a negative, preoccupied disaster. My father had fallen into a heavy depression, a pattern learned from his own father, disconnecting through sleep during the rare hours he wasn't selling cars, a job he had grown to despise. Once one of my biggest fans, he was now leaving the room when I'd ask if he wanted to hear my newest song. My mother, the woman who at one time laughed and danced on stage beside me, had also disengaged, holed up in her office playing endless games of Minesweeper. She began to look astonishingly unhappy and became so stressed she was hospitalized for debilitating acid reflux, an incident I missed while in New York attending MTV VMA after parties. Communication between them had become almost non-existent, each living in sadness triggered by personal disappointment. A family that had once exhibited the harmony of Full House had quickly turned into the Fishers from 6 Feet Under. I'd finally run into the first roadblock on my seemingly flawless journey into a new profession, which was painful, mostly because I knew I should have paid more attention. It's like on Splash Mountain at Disneyland, where the first 10 minutes are full of birds chirping and tiny animals singing songs about happiness and shit, but then right near the end, the music turns macabre and there's a